Dear friends, welcome to Military History Podcast, or Militärhistoria, as we say in Swedish. It is produced by Swedish Defense University's Department of Military History. I am Piotr Wawrzyniuk. I am teacher and researcher at the department. And our guest today is Henrique Garbino, who works at Swedish Defense University as a PhD student. He researches how non-state armed groups use landmines and other types of explosives. Henrique has a background in the Brazilian Armed Forces as a combat engineer and has participated in several international missions, most recently in Karabakh, but also in Ukraine. So obviously, because of your specialization, your subject, we'll be talking about landmines. Before focusing on your research, we will have an introduction of kind, a historical overview of development of landmines, types of landmines, legal framework concerning use of landmines. So let me ask the first question. What is a landmine?
First of all, thanks for having me in this podcast. It's my first podcast I'm recording, so I might not be up to standard, but let's see. That's up for the listener to decide, and you. What is a landmine? That sounds like a pretty straightforward question, but as every answer that I will give today, it's not as straightforward as possible. There is a military definition of a landmine, right? Which is something along the lines of an explosive charged in a container that is used to inflict damage or kill the enemy through an explosion or to some kind of a chemical or other component. So it's ammunition that you put somewhere and then you blow it up at some point. There is also a legal definition, for example, from the Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention, that says that a landmine is ammunition designed to be placed under, on, or near the ground, and it's designed to explode by the presence, proximity, or contact of a person or a vehicle. So in this definition, landmines are, by design, victim activated. In the military definition, it's broader. So you can have a landmine that is activated by the victim when a soldier, for example, an enemy soldier steps in it, or by, for example, command detonated devices, like by remote control. That's also a landmine in the military definition. So these definitions, they don't ally themselves. And I think this may sound like a bit of a petty distinction, but if you think of some types of landmines, if you change their fuses, they can be activated by the victim or they can be activated remotely. So you can have the same landmine in the stockpile, you just change the fuse, and one is illegal according to international treaties, and the other one is legal. So that's one thing to keep in mind.
First, we will elaborate a bit more on history and types of mines. So we have anti-personnel mines and we have anti-vehicle or anti-tank mines, as to when it comes to landmines, of course.
Yes, there are different ways to classify or categorize landmines. And if you think of their purpose, so why, which type of harm they intended to inflict against which type of target, then yeah, anti-personnel or anti-vehicle. And anti-vehicle, you can talk about anti-tank, also anti-landing mines, for example, against amphibious vehicles you put on beaches and all that. They're not sea mines, they're still landmines. There are even anti-helicopter mines, the ones that are projecting shrapnel towards up the sky. And before, there were also chemical mines that would release some kind of a chemical components, chemical agents, and even nuclear mines that were designed to, in the sense that remote controlled nuclear bombs that once, for example, the Soviet Union would invade Eastern Europe, then someone could press a button and a nuclear bomb would explode, I don't know, in East Germany. So those devices were designed as well. But you can also talk about how landmines differ by what activates them. We talked about victim activated already, command detonated. So there are different types of ways to activate a landmine: by pressure, by pulling a wire, by magnetic influence, vibration, time delay. There are also different types of mines based on their mechanical effects, like blast mines, fragmentation mines, shaped charge mines, direction fragmentation mines, some different kinds, and also by how landmines are emplaced, manually emplaced, mechanically emplaced, landmines that are that can be launched from afar, like scatter bomb mines. You can launch them from an airplane, a helicopter, a vehicle, or rockets, artillery munition, or even by hand. There is a hand-thrown landmines as well. And I think finally, you could also talk about more modern mines, like smart mines. So landmines that can be activated or deactivated by radio, landmines that have self-destruction mechanisms, self-deactivation mechanisms, or GPS, so you can kind of quite easily take them back. But those are much more modern ones that are coming up recently.
Okay, there is a lot to it.
Yeah, it's like the Booba Gump in the Forest Gump. Like you can have a
the shrimp
soup, grilled shrimp, shrimp with rice, shrimp with beans.
Just more scary when it comes to application.
Definitely. Yeah.
Well, as a historian, I simply need to know, when was a landmine used for the first time as such?
My short answer to this, and I'm no historian for the record, my short answer to this, it was the Crimean War. That's when the first or the closest thing to a modern landmine came to be. Before that, you can also talk about, you know, I've seen authors writing about that the concept of a landmine is much is an ancient concept in the sense of having something hidden that causes harm, like spikes or hidden pits with sharpie objects or whatever that you can see from the Roman Empire, for example. And I think started in the 4th century, there was also like gunpowder based devices that could be considered primitive landmines. But those were not high explosives. They were using gunpowder or black powder. And it's a bit ambiguous if they were victim activated or not. The thing is that they were black powder based. So black powder, as you know, it's very sensitive to humidity. So if they get damp, it's more likely to fail. You have to kind of seal it somehow, and that's complicated. Some of them, like a bit later, I think in the Franco-Prussian War, that the Prussians came up with this Fladermine or flying mine, which was the same principle. You have a bunch of black powder buried near the surface, and then, but this one was victim activated. So you had a flintlock, like the same you had in the muskets. So then when someone stepped on it or pulled the trigger or put a wire, it would activate the flintlock and burn the black powder and create some kind of a blast towards the victim. But again, flintlock and black powder are likely to fail when they get damp. But this concept of the Fladermine evolved into this fugas that you sure know about, and then you can add to the black powder charge rocks, some kind of shrapnel other materials, even flammable materials. So then you create a bigger flame. But those, because they could fail, they could be activated by your own troops. They were usually activated by someone controlling it. You would ignite a fuse. You would calculate when the enemy troops would be around the position, and you would initiate a fuse or a trench with black powder, and then you would activate. But then the effects were very minimal and also very likely to fail. Yeah, but so then it was the Crimean War then that actually Immanuel Nobel, the Swede, father of Alfred Nobel, he was commissioned by the Russian Tsar to help defend Crimea. And he invented the percussion cap, so which was basically a sealed glass bottle with a very sensitive explosive, mercury fulminate. And when the glass bottle broke, then that would create some kind of a energetic reaction, and that would activate a larger container containing black powder. So they used it in Crimea for both sea mines and landmines. And that's basically the same principle of many, many landmines do use today.
By the start of our conversation, you mentioned rather many types of landmines that are used all over the world. But please delve more into what kinds of landmines there are and how they have developed over time.
If we trace back from the Crimean War, for example, I think the first conflict that landmines were used in a greater scale was the American Civil War. They call it torpedoes back then, also because they started with sea mines or underwater mines. And then they took the same principle to the land. That's what why they had the name there. But then it were, I think, hundreds of victims from landmines in this American Civil War. So not that significant, right, for the whole conflict. So it was really in the World War One, end of World War One, that landmines became a more significant weapon. Again, there were technical problems. This idea of being unreliable, not unreliable that they wouldn't detonate when they're supposed to, that was a problem, but also very unsafe to make them and to install them. So if they fail when you're emplacing them, that's a major loss. So this mass production of landmines became possible when TNT was invented, and TNT is a much more stable explosive. You can manipulate it much easier. You can drop it and shoot it and burn it, and you won't detonate. So that makes it more reliable and safer for use. But during World War One, interpersonal mines already existed, but they didn't play a major role in defense, in defensive positions. The thing is, because machine guns and the barbed wire and artillery, they were perceived as more efficient methods of killing, of defending a position. It was actually by the end of the war, when the British started using tanks to break through the trenches, that the Germans responded with developing not only anti-tank guns, but also anti-tank mines. And the anti-personnel mines, they were used to protect the anti-tank mines from the potential deminers, or not even that back then, but other soldiers that would try to remove the anti-tank mines or deactivate them somehow. After the war, the First World War, the Germans continued developing anti-tank mines in particular. So they have had this Tellermine or plate mine, which is like a big dish, a lot of explosives for an anti-tank mine. And they also developed the shrapnel mine or S mine, which is a bounding fragmentation mine. Still the same principle is still used a lot. And the idea is that there are two explosive charges in this landmine. Once you activate it, the first one shoots up the mine around 1 meter up or waist high. And then the second charge explodes a charge of shrapnel in all directions. So it by going up, it really increases the range and the lethality of the landmine. This is an interpersonnel mine. And it was really World War II that saw the massive use of landmines, especially in North Africa and also East Europe, when there were a lot of flat terrain that very conducive for armored vehicles and vehicles in general. So then so there were large really large minefields being placed there. And again, the logic of the interpersonal mines is really to protect the anti-tank ones and protect them from the enemy deminers. I think Italy developed the scatterable mines and at World War II as well, but that wasn't really used that much. It was in the Cold War that the Americans and the Russians, and the Italians as well, developed scatterable mines, which are those you can shoot from artillery rocket or even an artillery howitzer munition or drop from helicopters. And those were, for example, widely used in Afghanistan by the Soviets. They were used a lot by the Russians now in Ukraine. So they're still being used. And the development of landmines is a bit like the armor, anti-armor dynamic, right? So landmines develop as the mining techniques develop. So throughout the years, you also saw mines being developed with no metal content. So landmines, they are fully plastic and chemical components, so there are no metals to be detected by the regular metal detector. landmines with anti-handling devices. So when you move the mine or you tilt it one way or the other, they explode, even if you don't step on it, for example. Or again, there's a Russian mine being used in Ukraine right now that detects the vibration of human steps. So a person cannot even approach the mine because it's going to be activated. So that's the, I think, a bit of an overview. There was a bit of a slowdown in the development process of landmines by the end of the 1990s because of the, I'm going to talk more about this, but of international treaties trying to restrict or ban interpersonal landmines. And even non-signatory states like the US, they never signed it, but they had agreed with Clinton to stop developing interpersonal mines. So I think that saw a little bit of a halt in the development for most states, not all of them, of course.
Yes, I believe that United States, Russia, China, they had not signed the treaty, and not Ukraine, as far as I know.
Ukraine did sign the Ottawa Convention and the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons. They did not sign the Cluster Munition Convention, though. But the most belligerent states, Israel, India, Pakistan, as you said, China, Russia, US, haven't signed.
Thank you for this fantastic overview over development of mines. Mass-scale employment of mines in a number of wars and armed conflicts all over the globe has resulted in landmine contamination. You have first-hand experience of landmine contamination and the challenges it poses. Can you develop on that?
It's hard to quantify the harm that's caused by landmines, because it's both an objective. I mean, you could do it both objectively or subjectively. You could count, for example, the number of victims, the number of people killed and wounded. And there, what is most frustrating about landmines is that most of the victims usually are civilians, usually in a post-conflict situation. So the war stops, yes. But people continue to fall victim of landmines. There are many children that fall victim of landmines in this context. For example, the latest data we have, yearly data, it's from 2022. And in 2022, there were 5,000 victims, wounded and dead. So in almost 50 countries. So it's a widespread situation. And if you think about these victims, it's not like being shot. It's a very traumatic experience. Landmines, interpersonal landmines, they don't have a big explosive charge, so they're not designed to kill, they're designed to wound. The idea behind it is that a wounded soldier is more costly to the enemy than a dead one. You need people to take care of them. It causes an emotional distress if you have someone bleeding and shouting and screaming. So it causes a psychological effect as well. But these effects are now being given to civilians, right? And that's the problem. So these people, the landmine survivors, they carry this trauma for their whole lives. Most of them are amputated. So they have the physical disability. They have to learn how to use a wheelchair or to use a prosthetic limb. Children cannot continue schooling because maybe they got blind from the explosion. So they struggle to find a job, to study. In many contexts, young women cannot find a husband in several societies. So this type of problems, they kind of reverberate into different areas. And that's only for the victims, for the direct victims. You can also think about indirect victims, so the family of the wounded, that child that the father got injured in a landmine accident, and now the children have to stop schooling to work instead, or the wife needs to take up a second or a third job to compensate, for example, or the communities. So there's this anecdotal case in Angola that a village of 3,000 people had been isolated from market, from resources, from medical services, because they were afraid of landmines around the village. And then there was a demining process in the region, and they demined the whole area, and they found only three mines. So three mines were holding 3,000 people hostage to the situation. So it's not really the actual landmine that causes the problem, it's the fear of landmines. You have the psychological effect that is, it's much harder to measure. And then you have this second or third order effects, agriculture that doesn't happen, economic development that doesn't happen because of this fear, tourism that doesn't happen because of the fear, and so on and so forth. So it's a broad problem. It expands much more beyond the actual device.
I have not thought of the problems as complex. You know about the victims, all right? You know about civilian victims, children, etc. The first example that comes up to my mind is Cambodia, right? where hostilities ceased around 30 years ago, but still thousands of people every year are wounded or maimed or killed by mines. But Henrique, what legal framework is there concerning use of mines? Do we have international legal framework?
We can start with the basics. We can start with the Geneva Conventions and customary international humanitarian law. So even without any treaty, so states don't need to sign this because that's considered customary law, is the principle of distinction in IHL, international humanitarian law. And the principle is that violence is allowed, is legal in an armed conflict if it's against combatants. So violence against non-combatants, it's always unlawful. And if you think of a landmine as a victim-activated device, which cannot distinguish between a combatant and a non-combatant, you could interpret that the landmine itself is going against this principle of distinction, which doesn't depend in any treaty whatsoever. There's also the idea in customary law that you shouldn't inflict unnecessary harm. So wars are ruled by laws, and when inflicting violence, you're not a sadistic combatant, right? You're there to achieve an objective. If you need to kill your enemy, you can do it, but inflicting as least harm as possible. That's why torture, for example, is unlawful. And the idea that we spoke about already, that antipersonal mines are designed to injure, you have in their rationale of their design, this idea of creating the psychological stress of the crying and screaming soldier bleeding to death in front of the others. So that could be considered unnecessary harm and also somehow unlawful or something to be avoided. So this is those two principles are the bedrocks of, let's say, a justification for why landmines should be banned. But then in 1996, there was this convention on certain conventional weapons, which is a broad convention with different protocols addressing different type of weapons, for example, incendiary weapons or blinding laser weapons, stuff like that. And Protocol 2 deals with landmines. It doesn't prohibit them. So the Protocol 2 of the CCW, as the convention is called, the Certain Conventional Weapons Convention, regulate the use of landmines, so both anti-personnel and anti-vehicle mines, and also booby traps. So we haven't spoken about booby traps, but just brief, booby trap is, in this context, an explosive device that is linked to a seemingly harmless item. So there's a box. If you open the box and it explodes, that's a booby trap. And by definition, it can also be considered an antipersonal mine. So the CCW Protocol 2 regulates the use of landmines and booby traps. For example, it states that landmines should, or minefields should be marked. They should be recorded for future demining. Antipersonal minefields or minefields with antipersonal mines should always be fenced and observed. So you cannot just lay a minefield and go home. You have to keep someone watching it. Also from a military tactical perspective, you want to hold your enemy there and then you want to inflict harm to the enemy. So that makes sense from a military perspective as well. This protocol also regulates the standards for how detectable mines should be. So they define that mines should have at least 8 grams of iron. So it could be picked up by detectors, and you couldn't have a trigger mechanism in the mine that activates by detector. For example, magnetic entrance landmine, which exists, by the way. For booby traps in particular, they said the protocol states that it can be used, but it cannot be used in certain areas. For example, you cannot put a booby trap in a dead body or anything related to children or health or food and water sources, or protected emblems like the Red Cross or the Red Crescent, and other restrictions, or graveyards, for example, and so on. And the other thing this protocol states is that the mining should be done as soon as possible after the conflict. And if you no longer control the territory that you mined, then you should still facilitate the mining from the opposite side. For example, by sharing your records or supporting that. Okay, so this protocol also talks about booby traps. It doesn't prohibit booby traps, but it restricts where they can be placed. For example, booby traps cannot be attached to dead bodies, not even dead soldiers. Nothing related to children, like toys, children, education materials, food and water sources, protected emblems, for example, the Red Cross and the Red Crescent, or in the UN symbol, for example, or graveyards, and there are other restrictions. Another final requirement of the protocol is that demining should happen as soon as possible. So even if the warring party that laid a minefield, if they don't control the territory anymore, they should still facilitate demining, even if the enemy occupies the area now. So they should, for example, exchange minefield records, minefield maps. Yeah, and of course there is the Antipersonal Mine Ban Convention, or Ottawa Convention, which fully prohibits antipersonal mine in every single way. For example, it prohibits the use, the transfer, the trade, the production, the development. It also requires that all antipersonal mines that a state has, they should be destroyed. You can only keep a very limited number to train the miners, for example, on it. But otherwise, it's zero interpersonal mines. And the idea is that the previous treaty that I mentioned, so the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, they allow landmines to be used in a certain way. But in the heat of battle, in war, things get foggy, right? In the fog of war. So you can always justify that, oh, but we were observing the minefields. Oh, there were marking. There were fences. We recorded, but then we lost the records. So to avoid these problems of monitoring and compliance with the treaty that regulate the use, the idea here is to fully prohibit. Yeah, so, and these are the most important, let's say, legal benchmarks in relation to landmines. Anti-tank mines are not covered by the Ottawa Convention. So they're not, doesn't mean that they're allowed, but it means that they're not prohibited by the convention. It's outside of the scope of the convention.
If we look at the use of landmines in Ukraine by now, what effect do you think it will have on the international attitudes towards landmines? Will the stress be put on the effectiveness of landmines as such and anti-personal mines as shown by the conflict, in the near future, or will we, the people in power, the people who actually will be discussing the future of use, continuous use of landmines, or will we rather stress the dangers and the potential suffering behind the use of such devices?
I think what has happened already, it's been going on. I think it has been working in both ways, as you mentioned. So in one way, Ukraine has seen this unprecedented level of contamination of mines, and also what it's called explosive remnants of war. So the combination of unexploded and abandoned ammunition, that some of them are as harmful or even more than a landmine. If you accidentally move it, step on it, it can explode. And Ukraine, it's definitely a massive scale, not only because the minefields are extensive, like in area and in number of mines, but also because it's very complex contamination, very complex minefields. You have a mix of several different types of, if you remember what we spoke about before, like different types of trigger mechanisms, mines that are activated by different type of activities, different types of mines, anti-personnel, anti-tank, from different models, from different countries. So I think there are like dozens of different countries that are supplying Ukraine and Russia with different weapons. So then it makes a very hard job for the deminer to come up with the efficient procedure to clean it, because he has to be prepared to find anything in the minefield. And that slows down the process, makes it more costly and more dangerous. So because of these challenges and all the suffering that it's been causing, not only to Ukraine, but also to the world, right, with food prices going up and so on, that is related to the conflict as a whole, but also with the demining problem, with a lot of agricultural area being inaccessible because of landmines at the moment. Yeah. So this highlights the humanitarian impact and also the like this reverberating effects that go beyond the conflict area. So I don't know, countries in the other side of the globe are suffering from higher prices of wheat partially because of landmines laid in Ukraine. And I think that reinforces the argument for a strong advocacy against the use of landmines. But at the same time, Russia has been holding ground, right? So partially because of this minefields and the defensive positions, I'm afraid that this could be seen as an argument in favor of the use of landmines. And you've I don't know if followed, but there's been, for example, in Finland, some discussion about going back to the landmines, to interpersonal mines, to protect the border, which they have abandoned a couple of years ago or several years ago.
No, I didn't know that, but that's what one could expect, because yeah, the Russian use of mines turned out to be so effective. So for several decision makers, for many countries, they might see it as very appealing, as an efficient way of dealing with an enemy.
Exactly. Yeah, it's hard to predict what's going to happen, but there are some positive developments. For example, when Trump was in power in the U.S., he withdrew this internal American policy that even though the U.S. is not a signatory to the TAR Convention, they would not use interpersonal mines and would not develop interpersonal mines except in the Korean Peninsula. So they could still use interpersonal mines in Korea, but they wouldn't develop any more mines. So Trump revoked this regulation, but then Biden put it up again. So at least this is a good indicator that at least the U.S., it's a key driver in this area, is at least aligning with the policy, subject to what's going to be the general trend.
You mentioned explosive remnants of war, being air bombs or artillery shells. I recall my boy years in Warsaw, in Poland, in the 70s and 80s, we have many accidents where perhaps 10 or 20 blocks in town were shut down because they found an air bomb. It could be 250, 500 kilogram or artillery shell. Nowadays, they are not as dangerous because they're simply outlined their time, so to say, but by then they were still deadly, and it was 30 years after the war. So that brings me to the subject of mine action, what it is and how it is regulated, and who does it.
That's a very good question. I mean, just a clarification before we start talking about mine action is that aging of ammunition, it is not a linear relationship with aging and being less dangerous. It really depends. So some ammunition, they get more unstable and more likely to detonate and inflict harm as older they get. But then, of course, after decades, the tendency is that they're going to become less dangerous. But you still have World War One bombs blowing up in Europe, right? So that's that they're still risky. Okay, but mine action. Mine action, the name is a bit tricky because it implies action for mines, but it's not, it's the opposite. Actually, in like Roman languages, French, Spanish, Portuguese, the concept is translated as anti-mine action. So action against mines. And that's what it is. It's all activities that are put in place to mitigate or remove the risks of landmines to the individual, society, and the environment. Mine action is divided into five pillars. And the first one is with the idea of avoiding new mine victims. So it's called Explosive Ordnance Risk Education, or EORE. And the idea is to inform people at risk about the dangers of landmines and explosive remnants of war. How to identify that an area is likely to be contaminated with landmines. So what are the signs or the warning clues that the environment is dangerous and what they should do if they find themselves in a dangerous position? And this is done to all sorts of populations. So from children below the age of seven and adults in different locations. You also have the pillar of victim assistance, which is once the harm is done, support the victim. And victim, you could argue that it's a term that removes the agency of the individual by placing them as a victim. So you could talk about survivor instead. But victim has this legal weight that is also used in the Ottawa Convention. So that's why the term is kept. And there's also a distinction between direct victims and indirect victims. So the person who is involved in the accident or with a landmine or an explosive remnant of war, that's a direct victim. There are families, there are communities that suffer indirectly from the fear of mines or from the consequences of that person not being able to provide for the family as before. Those are indirect victims. And victim assistance has both approaches. So targeting the individual who suffered with from the first aid to surgery, rehabilitation, psychological care, the family with livelihood support, and also the community with community-based interventions. Of course, you have the pillar of humanitarian demining, which is about finding where the minefields are, where the contaminated areas are, marking those areas, mapping those areas, and of course, removing all the threats. A difference between, for example, military demining and humanitarian demining is that in military demining, your goal is to open a breach. So you want to open a path or a road to a minefield, and then you're going to cross it. You're not concerned about removing all the landmines. You're concerned about the safety of the operation for yourself and the speed. In humanitarian mining, you're not concerned much about the speed because you're not going to put yourself at risk to do that. But you want to remove 100% of the landmines. The goal is to leave nothing behind. That's why it's a very time-consuming process. The fourth pillar is destruction of stockpiles. So the idea that you destroy the landmines that are available so you don't use them in the future. So this pillar has also to do with the safe management of stockpiles. The idea to support different states or or different groups that to keep their stockpiles safe in, so that criminal groups cannot take it and use it criminally or for terrorist attacks, for example. And also they, these stockpiles don't blow up accidentally. And the final pillar is the advocacy pillar. So the idea to promote and spread the known use or the norms of known use or regulated use of landmines and similar explosive devices to other actors. So we're spreading the word basically and make sure that more states become signatories, and also more recently that also non-state army groups can sign up basically to also unilaterally comply with the treaty. And you also ask who does it. A lot of different organizations. So who has the responsibility to do it? It's national governments. International organizations have the mandate to support mine action. Key among them are the United Nations Mine Action Service, or UNMAS, and the Geneva International Center for Humanitarian Demining. OSCE has their mine action units as well. You have also several international NGOs that conduct the mining themselves. You have the Halo Trust, the biggest, Mine Action Advisory, the Danish Refugee Council, Danish Church Aid, the Swiss Foundation for the Mining, and others. There are also private companies that can do humanitarian demining. They, for example, are hired by the government or by an international organization or even another private company to clear an area. And of course, they have to follow the same standards. But and also, the military can do it as well. So some contexts in Latin America, for example, the military has taken a huge role in demining. In Chile, Colombia, Peru and Ecuador, the Central American states as well, and Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador. Most of the demining was conducted by, and is being conducted by, the military.
So we're talking about mine action. It is a wide range of actions aimed at taking care of all the effects of mines, of ERWs, but also mitigating the negative health, social, economic effects of mines and explosives in a given territory. Is it right?
Yes, yes.
Now, that's a huge task. That's a huge task.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's no single organization that does it all. I mean, I talked about these five pillars, but usually organizations specialize in one or another. Yeah, so it's hard to do everything. That's why it's a multi-sectorial effort.
I would like to dwell a little bit on mine action still. Talk about the current challenges to mine action globally or in a given region. I suppose you know better than me. What are the preconditions of, let's say, successful mine action? Is there supposed to be peace? Obviously, it might be better to do it under peace conditions. It is a question. Is it a question of financing, obtaining necessary funds, education, and availability of personnel? What would you say?
There's all of that, I guess. Let's talk about challenges and opportunities at the same time, maybe. And if you think of the five pillars. Let me try to answer the question based on them as much as I can. If you think of explosive ordnance risk education, one main problem is then when you people they know that they are facing a risk, they are aware of the threat, they're aware of the hazards, but they perceive that they don't have any other alternative. So there are cases, for example, of people who have no other means of livelihood, and they have. So they collect scrap metal to sell. And then like an artillery shell, unexploded, or a 120 millimeter mortar grenade, that's a lot of steel there, very valuable, high quality metal that you can get some money with it. So there is several instances of accidents that happen with scrap metal collectors because they're trying to make a living. So trying not only to educate the people, or give this life-saving information that they need to be aware of the risks and avoid getting injured, but also giving them an alternative solution to their problem. So it's not only about sharing information, it's about helping them find a sustainable solution. And that's a much harder task. Another frontier in risk education nowadays is the use of online tools. So in a way, especially for children, you can kind of gamify risk education. You can make it more digestible, like TikTok-like messages that can reach a lot of people. For example, in Ukraine, that's used a lot because then the people have access to good mobile phone coverage, internet connection, so that works well. That doesn't really work well in all places. That's just one couple of thoughts. In terms of victim assistance, I think the challenge is not about the, in some regions, of course, minefields are far from, they're in remote areas, far from populated areas. So if an accident happens, it's hard to reach them. So there is this problem. Emergency care is often not within range. I remember I was working in Tajikistan, and I was doing some assessment on the landmine contamination between Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. Just as we submitted our study, or it was published somewhere, there was this landmine accident that happened in the border, in the place we were studying or investigating. And this shepherd, he got blew up on a mine, and he realized that no one would reach him in time. So he covered himself the snow. And we imagine that it was because he realized that, oh, I'm going to die. So at least let me preserve the body so it doesn't get eaten by animals or anything like that. So this is a big problem, how to reach the immediate victims. For humanitarian demining, it, as I mentioned before, it's a very long and time-consuming, dangerous, very costly effort. And we see that the challenges of Ukraine, for example, this complexity, and you have booby traps inside mines, you have booby traps under a booby trap in this very complex minefield. So this is going to take more time, more expertise, and cost more money, basically. So then there's, of course, a need for international funding. There is also new technologies that are being developed. So there's a lot of development with drones to detect mines and ERWs remotely. Those don't work perfectly as of now. So there are a lot of constraints in this technology. For example, they don't work that well if there is too much wind or if there is high vegetation, things like that. But they can be developed, and they will be developed better. The thing is that there is also, you cannot make demining too difficult. Most of the deminers are employed locally from the local village that is affected, for example, from the local region. So simple technologies work better. You can have a very fancy detector that combines ground penetrating radar with mesh detector with ground compensation in other technologies. But if the user is not comfortable with using these technologies, it's better to go back to a simpler version. So that's a bit of a trade-off there. If you consider beyond Ukraine, if you think about Syria, Iraq, Myanmar, Nigeria, or Colombia, where a lot of the mines used there are improvised, then you don't have a standard manufacturing process. So every mine is different. They can be more or less sensitive, different components. So that also makes it harder for the deminer or for the demining process. You cannot standardize it. For example, from a deminer's perspective, the ideal minefield is only with one or two types of mines. You have the map. You can follow the map. You can count how many mines you found versus how many mines were laid. So you know how many you missed, and so on and so forth. And in a irregular minefield, laid by irregular forces with no records and improvised devices, everything is a guess. You're never 100% sure about, oh, did we get everything? Of course, you can check the whole area, but it's much more complicated. And finally, in the advocacy part, one of the main challenges now is, let me backtrack a little bit. The Ottawa Convention is perceived as one of the most efficient or effective international treaties ever. There are maybe 100 and 164 countries. So I was saying the Ottawa Convention is perceived as being a very effective IHL treaty. It has 164 signatories. So it's really a handful of states who did not accept the treaty. And indeed, it has worked. So if you look back a couple of years, the only states that have confirmedly used interpersonal mines in recent conflicts, laid new mines, is like the Russian Federation, Syria, Myanmar. There are other allegations of other countries, but confirmed is only this tree. So most of the mine users nowadays are known state armed groups. Usually they don't lay mines to the same extent of a state actor. So less mines, smaller minefields, but they are the most frequent ones. The problem with the advocacy part here is that the treaties are made for states by states. So until recently, the early 2000s, no state armed groups didn't have a mechanism to abide by, formally abide by international maritime law. So this has developed as well. So there is this NGO called Geneva Call. They're, of course, based in Geneva. And what they do is that they engage different non-state armed groups and they offer these groups a deed of commitment. So basically an agreement, a piece of paper, where they unilaterally sign that they're going to comply with this part of international maritime law. And they started this process by working with the landmine issue. Now they have expanded to sexual violence in conflict, to child soldiering, and other topics. And once the armed group signed this deed of commitment, then this document is deposited under the Canton of Geneva. So it receives some kind of a formal status, legal status as well. It's not in the same level of an international treaty, of course, but it's a way towards that. So right now there are about 50 groups that have signed this deed of commitment. So they have accepted or unilaterally agreed not to use interpersonal mine. But there's hundreds more that haven't, right? So that's another challenge, another frontier to advance in the mine action sector.
Enrique, you've already touched upon the non-state groups and their use of mines a little bit. But since it lies at the heart of your research, what are the main differences between the use of mines between state actors and non-state groups? Apart from the fact that they obviously, as non-state group, they have not signed conventions, although you told us that it is now possible that a non-state actor can sign.
The deed of commitment.
And they also might want to create a symmetry. Towards the state actor, as one expects the state actor to be stronger, militarily stronger at least, and they must somehow compensate, yes, the shortcomings when it comes to firepower. Yeah. Apart from, let's say, guerrilla tactics, terrorism, whatever they might be using. What is your takeoff on that?
My PhD revolves around this question. So why would a non-state army group not use landmines? Because they have many reasons to do so, right? So there are two main arguments about justifying the widespread use of landmines by non-state groups. The one is the idea of that landmines are the perfect soldier. So Pol Pot, the Khmer Rouge leader, allegedly said that landmines are the perfect soldier because they're always ready, they never sleep, they never complain, they don't need to eat, they don't need water, they're better than all the other soldiers. And there's also the idea that you mentioned, that landmines being the weapon of the weak. Similar arguments have been made as well regarding terrorism being the weapon of the weak. That's debatable. But the idea for the landmine is that landmines are used to compensate for this asymmetry in power. Military power. So, and that resonates with many groups. I've been doing some research in Colombia, for example, and then the FARC, so the Armed Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, they have stated that landmines are our air force. So what the Colombian army would do is that they would bomb with helicopters the bases of the FARC, the camps, and then they would raid by land. So to protect themselves from these land raids, they would put a lot of landmines. So that's saying, so we counter the Colombian air force with the landmines. They are our air force. So that's clearly a thought that is prevalent there. How non-state army groups use landmines and how it differs from state groups, I think you could say on average that a state forces or government forces, they usually use landmines for defensive purposes, mostly like large minefields in the border or around bases in defensive positions. There are larger minefields, a lot of mines, they are mapped, they are maybe marked, though that's not always the case. And non-state groups, they would be more likely to use more sporadically mines, so less mines, maybe combine some strategic mine laying with an ambush. So when they ambush the government forces, the escape routes are mined, for example. Or even you've seen that in Africa, in Central America and Latin America, landmines being used to protect gold and diamond mines, coca crops in Colombia, for example, and even cattle. So cattle is not stolen, for example, in South Sudan. So you have this more economic rationale for using landmines. So there are different ways, but you can also find very professional and strong non-state groups and very deficient and untrained and undisciplined state militaries. If you compare, I don't know, the PKK in Turkey, they are one of the groups that have signed this deed of commitment not to use interpersonal mines. But before, they had been using landmines in different ways, and as far as I know, in a very professional manner as well, similar to a state military, you could argue. And there could be other militaries in other countries that are very, very poorly equipped. So they wouldn't be able to have a minefield record, for example.
Enrique, if you have to narrow it down to the very heart of your research, what are you researching right now? What are your results?
If I have to narrow it down in one sentence, I'm trying to find reasons for the known use of landmines for non-state army groups. So I have one article that came out last year. It's a case study or comparative case studies of three army groups in the Philippines. And I'm looking about how they restrict the use of landmines. They still use landmines, some of them, but how they restrict the use of landmines based on which audiences they relate to. So which audiences they rely on the most. And there, for example, I find that the New People's Army, communist guerrilla in the Philippines, for example, they still justify the use of interpersonal mines because they say that that's the only way they can fight the Philippine government. But they are very selective in who they target. So they're very careful in not hurting civilians, for example. And when they do by accident, then they even compensate the families financially. They pay for the medical costs and they apologize publicly. So they're really appealing to this local constituency. And then you have the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, which is the secessionist Islamic non-state group, which signed a peace agreement a couple of years ago with the government. But before, they had committed not to use interpersonal mines, but they still targeted civilians in different ways. For example, Christian Filipinos. So I was exploring this interaction about how landmines are used. Sometimes it may not mean much to say that you don't use landmines, interpersonal mines anymore, but you kill civilians in a different way. So that's one thing. Another article that I'm currently working on, it's about the Colombian paramilitary groups, especially the Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, or AUC. So they were one of the most brutal groups in all of Colombia's history. They were famous for massacres, burning villages, dismembering bodies and leaving them to rot in the city forbidding people to bury their relatives, killing people in front of their families, but they did not use mines. And you would wonder why, right? So in this research, I'm trying to find reasons of not using mines that are beyond this reputation aspect. So it's clear that they don't care much about what the international community has to say, what the government has to say. So they could have used mines and no one would have cared, for example. But so then in this study, I'm focusing on the more tactical logistics and also normative framework that doesn't prioritize the use of landmines. So in this article, for example, I tried to debunk this idea that landmines are the weapon of the weak, because they're actually very costly. You need to have some logistics capability to make them, especially if they're improvised. You have to have the know-how. You have a lot of victims of your own troops when you use mines, because eventually you're going to have an accident with your own mines. So you have to have some real need to use mines. They're not perfect. They serve a specific purpose. And when this purpose is not there, you're not going to use it. It sounds a bit simple, but it's been an interesting process. And of course, other articles coming up. But I'm trying to make use of the wealth of data that comes from humanitarian demining process and try to use that in more quantitative analysis as well.
Thank you, Henrique, and bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.